Yes, welcome back to Monday's edition here of World Football Daily. As I said, I'm a very tired chappy today. And there's a man who's joining me who is just as tired. He spent all his night up watching the Super Bowl last night as well. But there was also the floodlights going out at Craven Cottage that were a big factor this weekend. Jonathan Liu from The Telegraph is joining us to talk all things Premier League football. John, how are you, mate?
I'm very well, thank you. Cheers. Yeah, I'm a little bit bleary-eyed, but Looking forward to this chat.
Well, first,
it's going to be a good one.
First and foremost, mate, I'm really appreciate you coming on your day off. Of all the days that you need to get some rest and have some sleep after being up late last night, to come on is fantastic for us. And you've got a day off on a day when there's a big scandal taking place and breaking across the British papers here. A match-fixing investigation has found that there's potentially a Champions League game that was played in England to have been rigged in some way, shape or form. What can you tell us about this story as it's breaking, John?
Well, I mean, these obviously the match fixing thing, the Interpol investigation, it's been sort of bubbling under the surface for a couple of years now. The fact that, I mean, people have been talking about international friendlies and possibly sort of, you know, German league games, you know, other European leagues. But I don't think once somebody mentions the word England, it's a match in England. That's when people suddenly start sitting up and taking notice. It's clearly still in its early stages. There's not too many details available, but the fact that even the suggestion that a Champions League game in England could possibly be fixed, it certainly raised a few eyebrows and might explain a couple of performances in the last few years, to be honest.
Do you think that this is going to be a massive impact on the same way that the Italian match-fixing scandals have had an impact on Italian football? Do you think this could potentially be something that really is detrimental to English football's reputation?
I mean, what's the number? It's 380, I think they said. 380 matches have been fixed, including, you know, at least one in this country. I think it has the potential at this early stage, admittedly, it has the potential to be something pretty huge. I mean, we still don't obviously know the details, but there's not 380 meaningless matches in Europe. You know, some very important matches, some very big teams, some very well-known players will have been involved, unwittingly or not. I think, you know, this really does have the potential to unravel into something quite seismic.
Well, Jonathan, you'll be keeping your eye on this story, and of course we will as well here on World Football Daily. Somebody who might be thinking that his matches are being fixed at the moment is Rafa Benitez. Chelsea can't buy a win, let alone a point right now. Do you give credit to Newcastle for their win on the weekend, or do you take that credit away and say that Chelsea were actually just a poor performance and couldn't hold on at the end?
Well, I mean, I think you've got to give credit to Newcastle. They've clearly needed to do something over the window. Just to kind of bring in a few new faces and just refresh the club, really, to revitalise it. And it seems like that's what they've done. You know, good performance against Villa and this sort of last minute win. Teams don't generally pull off results like that, like, you know, in the manner that Newcastle did, unless the team spirit is good. So I think you've got to give them credit for that. The interesting thing about the winning goal is I don't know if you saw, I mean, at the other end, just before that, Demba Ba, he gets a little foul. I can't remember who it was who fouled him, but Demba Ba gets a little foul. It's not given. Newcastle goes straight up the other end and score a winner. So those are the margins. Those are the margins that you're dealing with.
In terms of Newcastle and their pillaging of the French league of its talent, what did you make of it initially when you saw that Newcastle were bringing in four or so players from Liga? Did you think this was maybe putting all the eggs in one basket, if you will? Did you think there was going to be this immediate impact from it?
It's the January window. It's a bit of a lottery, to be honest. If you look at traditionally who the biggest spending over the January window and the performances before and after, it actually makes very, very little difference. You'll notice that the teams that improved most in the second half of last season, teams like Wigan and Fulham, actually did very little business in the window. So that there are other bigger factors involved. But the difference with Newcastle is they've got this, you know, this incredible scouting network led by Graham Carr, as we all know. And they used the January window to good effect last season. They brought in Pepe Cissé. And they've not just brought in new faces for the sake of signing new faces. These are decent players. Debuchy, who you know, we all know from Euro 2012, Gouffran, Sissoko. very, very highly rated players. So I think it will have a positive effect. And it's not just, you know, your regular sort of January splurge or Redknapp, as I guess it's called in the trade.
Yeah, the Redknapp that took place this January at Queen's Park Rangers obviously didn't have as an immediate effect as Newcastle's spending spree did. QPR have been criticised for overbuying in transfer windows for the last 2 years or so now. Do you think Redknapp's done that again? He's brought in another, like, too many more cooks to spoil this already rotten broth that's being made.
Yeah, I mean the short answer is yes. I think Chris Samba has the potential to give them a bit of solidity. Loic Remy might well get them a few goals in the same way that Djibril Cisse did last season, but it really is, it's an incredibly short-term strategy. If it doesn't keep them up, then you're really looking at another Portsmouth or a Leeds, whatever the positive noises coming out of the club are. If they do go down, they'll find it very hard to shift somebody like Samba on the reported wages he's on. That's the thing with Redknapp. I mean, what Redknapp will do, he's an expensive date, essentially. You bring him to your club and you're like, well, it'll cost you. And that's clearly what Tony Fernandes is finding out. He may well keep them up. It's just a massive, massive gamble by Tony Fernandes and QPR.
Do you think the players that they've brought in, we saw Andros Townsend, we saw Jenas come off the bench and obviously Samba, are they good enough and impactful enough players to be able to keep QPR afloat here?
I've seen quite a bit of Townsend at Tottenham. He played the odd Europa League game last season. Personally, I don't think he is. I think he's got promise, but he's not the kind of guy who's going to wrench you out of a relegation dogfight with a single-handed act of brilliance. Nor is Jenas for all the admirable things he's done over his career. What it really is Redknapp just saying, buy me lots and lots of players. One or two might well turn out to make the difference, but you know we're going to have to get quite a few before we find out. That seems to be the strategy, a kind of a carpet bombing strategy. Because I mean, Redknapp comes in, he has a look at the squad, which, by the way, is spent very heavily, brought in a lot of players in the last two or three transfer windows, not just this one. And he thinks this clearly won't do. So it's really a kind of a psychological revitalisation of the squad. If that makes any sense, rather than the actual players that he's bringing in.
What about the attitude in that squad? It didn't look like there was much gusto coming from Rangers against Norwich. It was a very bland game anyway, as we've seen from QPR in a couple of weeks recently. But it really didn't look like that they had this fighting battle mentality inset in their heads that you'd expect a side in the bottom three at the moment to have.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite clear from the last few weeks that Redknapp had made his priority the defence, which was pretty much leaking goals of fun earlier in the season. But it's going to be sort of a fairly drawn out process. They could quite easily have lost that game. But what it seems to me is happening there is that Redknapp is trying to shift the mentality of QPR. We're not going to lose. We're going to be solid. We're going to be tight. And if that means we've got to play out a few kind of dull nil-nils and look a bit drab for a while, then so be it.
Jonathan, at the other end of the table, Manchester United and Manchester City still storming away, obviously, from Chelsea. It is a two-horse title race now. Is it a one-horse title race, though? Mancini said that he feels City are still in this title fight. Doesn't look like it, though, at the moment, with United winning and City stumbling and drawing once again.
Yeah, I mean it's a 9-point gap now. I mean, for all sorts of City's quality, I don't see a player or a group of players that really is going to go on a run of 12 or 13 wins in a row, which is essentially what Mancini has said. You know, he said yesterday that's what they need to do. They need to win 13 games in a row. I don't see that kind of mentality. I don't see United dropping that many points, especially with Rooney looking though he's coming back into form. With Kagawa, you know, just you know, coming back into form and fighting his way to fitness, I don't see how City pull this back. I really don't.
Do you think the difference between the two sides is that United have this mentality of down at Craven Cottage, it's still late, but they still think that, you know, 3 points is going to be theirs, and Rooney ends up getting that goal late on. City, on the other hand, don't. Despite what happened at the end of last season, still haven't got that grinding out a win and just getting the job done kind of mentality still.
Yeah, and I mean that's what worked them so well last season. I don't think their mindset is too far off. I mean, they have ground out, managed to grind out quite a few sort of Dow 1-0 wins over the season. What I think is missing is that too many of their players who really did perform for them last season just haven't done it. I don't think Aguero's had a very good season. Obviously, Balotelli is now gone. I don't think Tevez is struggling for goals. When Dzeko and Silva and Aguero are on form, they will win. But they haven't been doing it often enough this season, and that seems to be the main reason why they're 9 points behind.
Do you think David Silva's recovered from that slump that he had in the second half of last season? He started last year so well in the first 12, 15 games or so, and then really drifted off towards the end of the year. Have we seen him bounce back from that yet, or is that still hanging over him, do you think?
It's an interesting thing about David Silva. I don't think he's yet put together a full season at full potential, and that's partly due to the fact that in 2010 and 2012 he's had international tournaments to recover from. I don't think Silva has really managed to put together a 38 game in form streak yet. He's coming into the season. He wasn't really there for the first sort of 10, 15 games, but I think we are seeing a little bit more from him now. And City need him. City really do need him to perform because they're kind of short of creativity.
A man that is very creative all the time and was obviously featuring in that City game, but in a red shirt, Luis Suarez, looks like he's found an ideal partner up front for him in Daniel Sturridge. Are there people at Chelsea now looking over to Liverpool and thinking maybe we should have played Sturridge down the middle at some point?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's Sturridge has started incredibly, and it's been heartening to see, I think, especially from an England fan's point of view, how well Sturridge can play when he really feels he's wanted at a club. I think at Chelsea he felt as though, I mean, Villas-Boas played him quite often. I don't think Di Matteo saw him as a key player. I don't think Benitez ever really saw him as a key player. And he's a kind of player who really needs to feel like he's the main man. And I think Rodgers has treated him very well. He's bigged him up. He's given him the big sort of fanfare. He said, right, go on, lead the line. Suarez can create chances for you. And that really sort of bolsters his confidence. You saw, he's taken on shots. He's taken on players that he probably wouldn't have done earlier in the season for Chelsea.
Do you think it's beneficial to him to have somebody like Suarez there, not only because of the creativity and the talent that Suarez has got? Obviously, he's fantastic. But there's far less pressure on Sturridge's shoulders, even despite the £12 million price tag and people saying that this could be his last chance at a big club.
Yeah, I mean, and the Liverpool sort of lack of striker was pretty much their Achilles heel all through the first half of the season. It was pretty much Suarez or nothing. I still think Liverpool need to see more from Barini. They need to see more from Suso. Because Sturridge, as good a player as he is, he's not necessarily gonna bang in 10 or 12 goals over the rest of the season and drag Liverpool into the Champions League. But there will come a dip at some point, and Suarez has been due a dip for about 18 months now. So, I'd be wary of putting too much responsibility on Sturridge's shoulders, but the early signs are very encouraging.
Do you think this is a Liverpool side that could push for the Champions League, though, towards the end of this season? They're 11 points off the fourth place at the moment.
I don't think they've quite got the depth at the moment, especially in midfield. And the other thing, which I guess is one of the major talking points that came out of the City game, is they don't really have a decent keeper anymore. I can't remember the last time that Pepe Reina was actually, one of the best keepers in the Premier League. He slipped way down the order, and that kind of mistake was the sort of thing that if it had been David De Gea, it'd have been rumours of transferred in the offing. So that's really what's gonna happen in this season. Next season's a different matter. If they sort of spend in the window and bring in a couple more faces and actually gel as a unit, that could be more of a possibility for them.
Could you see United and Liverpool battling out to maybe bring in somebody like Begovic, who it seems all things set up with Jack Butland joining Stoke that he's going to be on his way out of the Potters?
Yeah, it seems like that's what that's what Stoke have been preparing for by bringing in Butland. There was talk of Chelsea being interested as well. I think it's possible. I think Ferguson will stick with De Gea because he is, if nothing else, a stubborn little so-and-so. And he might well give De Gea another season, especially if he pulls out a few performances towards the end of the season. Liverpool, again, it's probably time for them to start looking beyond Rayner, but it's whether they want to take that symbolic step of essentially dumping him on the scrap heap, which is what they would be doing if they brought Begovic in. I think it's possible that they could both be in the market for a keeper this season. This summer.
Jonathan, you've been, I noticed on the Telegraph website, you've been looking at Peter Odemwenge just quickly before we let you go. And obviously everything that happened during the transfer window, and you said that you felt a few years ago this wouldn't have been such a big deal. Just explain to us why you don't think this would have been a big deal a few years ago as opposed to now. Is that just because of the media intensity around deadline day that you're talking about there? And for West Brom, how do they go about reintegrating Odemwenge into their side again?
Yeah, well, I mean, essentially, Sky Sports News has been a game changer in terms of how big deadline day has become. There was a time when I don't know if you remember, but deadline day was something that you'd follow on the radio. You'd go to CFAX page 302 and you'd sort of you'd refresh the page, or the page would flick over with all the transfers. And now, I mean, Sky Sports News, I think I've read they've got 100 reporters in the field. They are, they've got cameras everywhere. They are going to catch something. 10 years ago, Odemwingie might have turned up at the club, got turned away, and nobody would have known except, four or five people that happened to be passing at the time. In terms of, what happens now for him, I think it may well be that the transfer to QPR will be off. And if you think about it, he's 31. He's probably on a fairly decent wage. And it's hard to see too many teams that would take a gamble on him in the summer. So it might be in his best interest to kiss and make up with West Brom as soon as he can.
Well, let's hope that can be done and everything can be sorted as all the fallout from deadline day starts to filter back down into the back of our minds. Jonathan, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show once again, mate. We appreciate you coming on, especially on your day off, and taking time to join us here on World Football Daily. Now get some rest, mate, because it was a late night last night for you.
Cheers, Ollie. Thanks a lot.
No worries. Have a good day, mate. Jonathan Liu there from the Daily Telegraph joining us here on World Football Daily. Absolutely love Jonathan. Go to the Telegraph's website, go to the football pages and see some of the back catalogue of his work. It's great. He brings in the really detailed, accurate opinion pieces on the game itself, but then also throws in these kind of wonderful pieces that add so much kind of humour and criticism of the broadcast media in the UK and the whole hoopla surrounding football as well, in a very educated but still hilarious style to read. I'm a big fan of Jonathan there. Raph, you were watching quite a bit of Premier League football this weekend. What caught your eye as we were flicking through the scores?
Well, I mean, I love the fact that they're basically giving the title already to United. I definitely watched the City Liverpool match. I kind of thought that City were going to they stumble over their own feet oftentimes. And I think that they did it to themselves again this weekend. And now they have quite the mountain to climb. I think I gave it, to Chelsea or I called a draw in my TalkSport, Premier League predictor this weekend for the Chelsea Newcastle match. But I knew that Chelsea were going to bottle it. I just kind of felt it. And sure enough, I think they did, man. Obviously they did.
They did, It was
Spurs.
Pretty sterling performance on his debut for Newcastle by Moussa Sissoko, grabbing two goals and really being a big handful for Ashley Cole all afternoon in that game. I was really impressed by the way that Newcastle have made a huge effort. That's one thing, to gel these players into the side as soon as possible. I don't know if you saw, there's a picture that's been around Twitter and the internet of the dining area at the Newcastle training ground. They put like big French flags up and banners kind of saying, "Oh, welcome guys," and all this kind of thing. And really just trying to make it feel at home as possible. And
The fans at the Sporting Direct St. James's Park. We're all decked out in their with their French flags, red, white, and blue, and you saw people in berets with the very kind of elaborate French mustaches and stuff like that. They had somebody had a shirt saying bienvenue mes nouveaux amis. I think that was about right. But welcome to my new French friends, basically. I think they're embracing this whole French Revolution thing.
And you know what? It could be a really fun thing for the club to do as well. I mean, can you imagine, the guys on the stalls outside St. James's Park on a Saturday afternoon selling a beret with a Newcastle badge embroidered on it, or a big kind of, the blue and white striped hoop shirts that the stereotypical Frenchman kind of wears. And you could imagine like the Newcastle fans turning up to the ground wearing those and the beret and like some garlic around the neck kind of thing and just having a laugh with it. And really turning it into we're integrating people, but turning it into a bit of a giggle as well.
Takes this to the extreme, and next season, should they, you know, keep some of these French players, do they have a new Newcastle football kit?
Oh, like, no, they have
that, like you said, that very thin blue and white stripe, you know, stereotypical French.
As the away shirt, yeah, or the third shirt or something like that. That would be quite cool, or a training shirt. That'd be if Mike actually went and the whole hog and did that, that'd be cool. Or if he did the, you know, Swansea's away kit is the red shirt with the white shorts and the green socks, you know, red, white and green, traditional kind of Welsh flag colours. If they did that with the away shirt at Newcastle and made it like, I don't know, red, blue and white, and had a kind of a French motif going through their away kit or third kit next season, you could see them having a laugh with it. And to be honest, the Geordies are such a good laugh with this sort of gag that they could take it and run with it. It really could. I mean, you know, you'd be selling, they could be selling, you know, hot baguettes outside the ground rather than burgers and stuff like that. It'd be a really good laugh.
There'd be a creperie just outside the stands. Yes, they would be selling creperies.
Yes, I will have a pint of Kronenbourg 1664 and a crepe with Nutella, please, for my half a time pain.
I will have a crepe with strawberries, s'il vous plaît.
Les pommes fraises, it could be an absolute laugh up there at Newcastle. It would be a hell of an experience for anybody to go up there, kind of walking into
Geordie. It feels like the fans would definitely be all for it, man. And I feel the French Revolution has just begun up in Tyneside, as they say.
It would be one hell of a revolution as well. It would be very weird having a French Revolution with a Geordie accent twist. Whoa, wait, hey, man, like, I bloody love that. They're French, like, oh, can I believe it? It's, I don't know, I'm trying to think of my old kind of high school French, and I can't think of anything right now. Je suis, man. Je suis Clive.
Je suis un Jordi.
Yeah, exactly. I think we're digressing here slightly away from the football on the weekend.
Nous sommes magpies.
Yes, Raph. Exactly. You are set and ready for this trip to Newcastle now, aren't you, mate? You need to get your flight booked.
You know what? I'll be Geordie for a weekend, man. I'd do it
before the end of the season. You should get yourself over to England and come and see Newcastle, mate. There was plenty of shocking scorelines going on this weekend in the Premier League. Everton against Aston Villa was just a thrill a minute. The 6 minutes of injury time, Raph. This is a fantastic new system. It seems like every single time in the last week that we've had a game where it's been 6 minutes of injury time.
As if 5 minutes were enough. I agree with you. I know where you're going with this one, because they used to just do like 5 minutes was like the maximum, right? Like 5 minutes. It's like, oh, that's a long time, man. Oh, that's like Fergie time, big time. But the 6 minutes, whoo. Yeah, go ahead, man.
Well, this gives such a lift, because if you think, oh, there's only 5 minutes left, God, we can get something out of this, but, you know, it's going to be tough. When 6 minutes comes up, it seems that everybody in the crowd goes, six? That's like an extra half hour almost. Bloody hell, we can definitely get two in this one. And you saw it in the Everton fans and the Everton players when 6 minutes of injury time came up on that board. In the same way that Juventus rose to the occasion when 6 minutes came up in the Coppa Italia semi-final second leg last week, it really just lifted the whole place around Goodison Park. And Fellaini, of course, getting the very, very late 93rd minute header from a corner. Aston Villa and corners. I mean, geez, what do they need to do? They score two goals with their first two shots in the game. Benteke and Agbonlahor giving them a 2-1 lead going into the break. They had a third after half time. And 3-1 up with 20 minutes remaining, Raph. You're thinking even Villa can't botch this one up, really. Even Villa, with this weakened young side inexperience, they've been holding out reasonably well. Benteke was fantastic on the weekend. Anicebe caused problems, though, for the back four. And Ron Vlaar and Kieran Clark, some people have been giving them kind of in their post-match player ratings, has been giving them, you know, sevens and eights. There's no way those guys are getting a seven and eight, in my opinion. Kieran Clark gets absolutely annihilated by Anicebe for Everton's first after 21 minutes. And then, as I say, Fellaini was striking twice late on with 20 minutes to go, and then in the 93rd minute to bring Everton level. Villa are absolutely up the creek without a paddle here. Absolutely up the creek. Yakuba Silla came on, their new superstar 1.5 possibly less, according to a couple of journalists who've been chatting with Lambert recently. £1.5 million midfielder from French Ligue 2, Yacouba Silla, came on, gave the ball away three times and gave away two free kicks. Should have been booked. Did end up getting booked as well. Absolute waste of money, it seems, that he's going to be. He's not exactly made the immediate impact that we're all looking for and Aston Villa fans are looking for. And I still don't think that that Dawkins is on loan from Tottenham. He's going to be a good enough player to revitalise and regenerate. It's like just bringing in a body for the sake of bringing in a body to keep the fans quiet. Really disappointed by Aston Villa on the weekend at the fact that they've not got the mental composure. They don't have... I mean, Westwood played well, but Karim El Hamadi's not done anything since coming in January and really has been a poor buy in terms of output for that club. Andrea Weimann tries hard, but I still think he's lacking in confidence and in quality to an extent. Charles Nzogbia. Do you remember Charles Nzogbia at Wigan, Raf? I think we all remember those days when you'd look at Nzogbia and think, God, he could play in, like, you know, a top eight side, this lad. Like, he's looking awesome. Mazy runs, great touch on the ball. Charles Nzogbia has gone away and gone to sleep for Aston Villa. No idea where he is. They only have Benteke right now. Fellaini, on the other hand, was fantastic for Everton. Leighton Baines, excellent at left back. Johnny Heitinga had an absolute mare, but luckily Phil Jagielka was able to kind of cover up when needed. It wasn't a great day for Tim Howard. Neither him or Guzan are going to be pleased about conceding three. Tim obviously on his way to the US men's national team squad as they prepare for that that World Cup qualifying hexagonal tournament game against Honduras coming up on Wednesday. It's a big weekend. Tim won't have wanted to go in into the international break with three goals hanging over his head, especially in a poor performance by him in general. His distribution, his kicking, his confidence was awful on the weekend. Do you think Howard has this hanging over his head, Raf, going into the US game this week?
Something tells me that he's not one to kind of dwell on this kind of thing. Especially with the general good form that Everton find themselves in this season. I feel like this is probably like a one-off for him. And I feel like he shakes this off pretty easily. I think he's more concerned with the environment he'll be going down into when he heads to Honduras this week.
We do have the international friendlies and the international fixtures coming up this week. We will be getting into them as we go through the week this week. And of course, Daniel Sturridge pulling out of the England-Brazil game this weekend. It's only a friendly, so it's not too big a deal at all. I was very impressed by him for Liverpool against Manchester City. City just there and thereabouts, just getting by at the moment, but I don't think they're doing enough at the moment to, as Johnny said, Johnny Lou said from the Telegraph a moment ago, doing enough to get their hands on some silverware this season. In all credit, I didn't really agree with what John said about Aguero. I think he's been a shining light in terms of the goals that he's scored and the attitude he's kind of taken onto the pitch at Manchester City. Always works so hard, and
it was
what
such
a finish.
Yeah. What a finish. A goal from him from the weekend.
I mean, you see on the replay, as he goes round Reina, he looks up as he's kind of passing Reina, and then it's just head down looking at the ball, and he knows exactly where the goal is. He doesn't even need to look up, and he just dinks it. Somebody said, oh, do you think that's a cross? Like, no way. No way is that an attempted cross. That is a fantastic little finish from mm-hmm. such an acute angle. You do have to question, what is Reina doing at that point, though? That moment of madness, getting caught in no man's land. We saw it happen with the Brentford keeper a couple of times when they played Chelsea. But that was ridiculous what Reina's doing there. Comes flying out of his goal, overcommits himself. And as Jonathan Lewis said to us, I mean, if that was De Gea, you would be saying, oh, another classic De Gea mistake. Pepe Reina makes mistakes every season. Like, there's a couple of big ones that he has every year. I remember one where the ball was coming down from a great arcing loop, and he kind of tipped it onto his own crossbar and went in on into the back of the net. A completely ridiculous mistake for somebody of his quality to be making. But do you have questions about Reina? Do you think that the Liverpool should be sticking with him for next season still?
I think he's perfect for Liverpool right now. He's not really going to cost you too many points, I think, overall in the season. And I think he is what he is, and that's the third-string Spanish keeper.
Yeah, definitely the third-string Spanish keeper. It was a cracking weekend of Premier League football. We're going to have to move away from that in just a moment here on World Football Daily. We can't dominate it with the English stuff because the Bundesliga gave us a thrilling game between Dortmund and Bayer Leverkusen. Mario Balotelli striking two as well on his debut for AC Milan to give him a 90th-minute win against Udinese. Serie A proved some major thrills and spills this weekend. as did La Liga, as Atletico Madrid start to work down the gap between Barcelona. All that and more coming up next here on World Football Daily.